Morning, Chief Justice, members of this honorable court. May it please the court, Eric Mooney on behalf of Jennifer LaFave. This case is squarely about probable cause, what evidence is to be considered, and the standard to be used in considering that evidence. I'd like to point out first that in the briefing and in the prior oral argument, the state has argued that several of the observations of the initial officer, Officer Short, should be considered in determining probable cause. I would submit to you that that is not the case for two reasons. One is that Officer Short is not the arresting officer. If Officer Short were the one who arrested Ms. LaFave, then all of his observations could be considered in the totality of the circumstances in determining probable cause.
Well, that's a conclusion. What's the reason you take that position?
Because he is merely a witness, Your Honor, and he is not the arresting officer. In order for Officer Short's observations to be considered in probable cause, they would have had to be communicated to Officer Page.
Okay, so the gap you find is not the fact that he wasn't the arresting officer necessarily, but that the information he had that would arguably promote a finding of probable cause wasn't communicated to the officer who made the judgment of arresting.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the only reason why I use the first example would be, let's say that Officer Short had observed everything, and then Officer Page had somehow come on the scene later, and then Officer Short makes the decision to arrest, then everything that Officer Short observed could be considered because ostensibly he's taking into account everything that he's observed in making the decision to arrest. That didn't happen in this case.
Did Short tell the other officer who actually administered the so-called objective test to make the arrest?
He did not. I think, Your Honor, that I can get into that in a moment. It appears as though in the video that Officer Page was never going to arrest Ms. LaFave. At the conclusion of the field test, he tells Ms. LaFave, go back and get in your car. It would stand to reason that the arresting officer, after conducting the field test, that's the moment after the person blows into the portable breath test that the arresting officer or the investigating officer makes the decision of whether or not to arrest. That flies in the face of that when he says, we'll go back and get in your car. He then walks over to Officer Short, who was a superior officer, and shows him the PBT and says, she did well on her field test. And Officer Short says, she's drunk. And he says, yeah, okay. And then he goes back and says, come back and turn around and put your hands behind your back. So I would submit that that's evidence that even Officer Page, the arresting officer, didn't believe that there was probable cause for the arrest after administering the field test. Now, I'd like to...
Why does it matter what he believed? Isn't it an objective test?
It would not be, in my opinion, Your Honor, appropriate to inject facts that the arresting officer was not aware of and somehow use them in the equation of determining probable cause. There could be lots of things that happened that
my reference was to what he believed. That's what you just said. Did you misspeak?
Well, either what he believed or what he's aware of.
And what do we know that Page heard from Short? We know from what you just said, you know, Short said she's drunk. That's kind of at the end of the scenario. But the facts indicate Short was following the car down the highway. He made this reference to look like, you know, girls gone wild. And he called for someone else to come and actually make the arrest, in quotes. But what was communicated to the officer, Officer Page, as to why he was asked to be there? Do we have anything in the record that describes her going down the highway, changing lanes, bouncing around in the car?
Your Honor, and I can speak to that directly. On Page's cross-examination, which is as part of the record, page B6 starts out line 5. The question is from myself, okay, when you showed up to the scene, what did Trooper Short tell you? Answer, he advised me that the vehicle was tailgating the defendant's vehicle, was tailgating another vehicle, and that he was beside it. He observed this, and then he followed it across the canal bridge and then pulled it over when it pulled into the parking lot of the Just in Time. Question, and in fact, he told you that there was a female, the passenger, was hanging out of the window. Is that what he said? Answer, that's correct. Question, did he ever say anything to you about the driver? Not that I recall on the initial conversation with Sergeant Short. Question, okay, so he never told you that the driver's speech was slurred? Answer, not that I recall. Question, okay, he never told you that the driver did anything? Answer, well, the driver was tailgating. Question, I'm sorry, but he never said that the driver did anything with regard to acting crazy, yelling, screaming, intoxicated, anything. Is that correct? Answer, that's correct. So the information that's communicated from Short, who is a witness, to Page's interpretation of that is that this driver was tailgating. Never communicated to Short, never communicated to Page anything about the girls going wild, the being able to tell that somebody was intoxicated by seeing them drive by. And that's where I started out at the beginning of this, is that seems to be where the state has focused their argument, both in briefing and in the prior oral argument, by saying we have to, in order to assess the totality of the circumstances, we have to go back to what Page saw on Route 1 when he saw women in the car acting like girls going wild, and women that were had slurred speech, and women that were obviously intoxicated, and driving within a foot of the bumper, and the car couldn't pull over in time. None of that's an absolute red herring, because none of that was communicated to Page. Page could not have considered that in the probable cause analysis because it was not communicated to Page.
Why is it incorrect for us to determine that the probable cause analysis, considering the totality of the circumstances, is based on what both officers knew, particularly when it's Sergeant Short who, in a fair reading of the record, orders the arrest?
I don't think that he orders the arrest, Your Honor, because and he couldn't for a couple different reasons. One is that he's not involved in any of the post-stop testing. He's not involved in any of that. So,
well, isn't that the essence of the case, though? Sergeant Short says to the arresting officer, for lack of a better term, she's drunk, after he comes to Sergeant Short basically saying she's passed the objective test. When he says she's drunk, doesn't that mean that he's made the subjective judgment based on what he's observed, that she's under the influence, regardless of the result of the so-called objective test? And that turns Page around, and as you just stated, he brings her back out of the car and, to use the vernacular, locks her up. Why isn't that ordering him to make the arrest?
If he does order him to make the arrest, I would submit to the court that that's would be improper, and probable cause wouldn't exist at that point. And if you go back earlier in the tape, when Officer Page,
what I'm having trouble with is the concept that with two police officers on the ground, each having made differing observations about an individual that's in the zone of arrest, so to speak, why it's wrong to consider the total observations and have to focus on who actually ministerially makes the arrest. Why is that wrong?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that's consistent with what prior case law is that The arresting officer has to be aware of facts and evidence in order to be, that to be considered in the probable cause analysis.
Yeah, but we're talking about two officers on the same scene here. We're not talking about an arresting officer that did not, acting alone, who did not know about information that someone else had. We've got an officer saying, she's drunk, he's the sergeant, the other one's the trooper. It results in her being arrested in a combination of knowledge of the two. Now, articulate for us why that is inconsistent with case law.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the case law is clear that the arresting officer has to be aware of the other observations in order for that to be taken into the probable cause analysis. That's number one. Number two, Short makes the comment to Page.
So probable cause can only be based, even under this factual scenario, on what the arresting officer knows.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm just asking.
I believe that that's the
You're here to educate me. I'm simply asking. Yeah.
Hey, Mr. Mooney, on that subject.
Yes, sir.
The brief submitted by the state tells us that Short relayed his observations of Lafitte's driving and her person, as well as his belief that she was clearly under the influence of alcohol. I'm reading from page 5. Then the brief goes on with citations to the record and says, based on his observations in conjunction with his training and experience, Sergeant Short concluded that Lafitte was under the influence. And then on the next page, it says that Trooper Page approached the defendant and also smelled the strong odor of an alcoholic beverage when she spoke. And then it goes on.
Yes, sir.
Do we have an issue of fact here? I mean, a dispute of fact? Because the argument that you're making is premised on there not being a communication of those facts, and yet we're told there was.
Your Honor, there's three separate periods of time that what I'm focusing on is what Short communicated to Page prior to the arrest, which in my view is the operable period, because you can't consider things that Page didn't know about in his decision to arrest.
You're saying that these facts were communicated after the arrest, but not before?
Some of them were communicated after the arrest, and some of them weren't communicated until trial. The suppression hearing. Officer Short never said before or after the arrest that that it was a girls going wild type of situation. He saved that for the hearing. Trooper Short never said before or after the arrest that the defendant had slurred speech. He saved that for the hearing. The only difference between what was said before the arrest and after the arrest, after Trooper Page decided to arrest, Trooper Short said there was a passenger hanging out of the window. This is after the arrest. There was a passenger hanging out of the window. The car came up on a car and almost slammed into the back of them. She is reeking of alcohol. And then he says, so it's following too close. She does not have insurance, and the passenger just happens to be ignorant. That was the totality of what Short communicated to Page after the arrest. Prior to the arrest, I'm sorry.
Can I stop you for a moment?
Yes.
Is it possible to have two arresting officers?
Yes, I think it is, Your Honor. But
and why isn't that what we have here?
Because number one, this officer is on a completely different duty. He's in an unmarked car, and he communicates to Page at the beginning of the conversation when Page shows up. Page asks Short, "Did you do anything with her?" And he says, and I quote, "I did not do field tests on her, figured it would be easier if I did not start anything." So clearly this is not a situation, Your Honor, where there is a call and several officers respond and several officers see different things, and somehow that can be melded into a communal decision to arrest. That's not what this case was. This was an officer in a plain, unmarked type of vehicle on a separate duty, a drug enforcement type of duty, sees some things, blocks the car in, calls for an on-duty trooper, and then tells him, I didn't do anything with her because I figured it would be better if I didn't start anything. He is acknowledging at that point that that investigation needs to go on with a road trooper who is equipped to investigate a DUI. And in fact, that's what happens. He hands it off to that officer. Page then administers field tests while Short is off in the background, not participating in those field tests.
But he didn't leave, right?
He did not leave.
And ultimately, he basically said to Page, she's drunk, right?
He does say that when Page seems as though he's not going to arrest her.
Okay, so why? You're making a nice distinction and saying, no, Short was on a different duty and he didn't do things and he passed it over to Page and all. But the fact is that they were both there. Short observed half of the things that went on, and Page observed what he did by doing the field tests. And you put them both together, and arguably there's probable cause. But you're saying, no, you can't put them together because only Page was the arresting officer. And I'm asking, why is it wrong to look at this as two arresting officers, one of whom, because of the nature of his duty, was not going to take the, you know, write up the paperwork and so on, and calls for the other one to do the field test. But the first officer is authorized to arrest somebody, isn't he?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So why is it that you parse them out and say only one of them was the arresting officer?
For two reasons, Your Honor. And it's the same reason, but it's two reasons. One is Page is not aware of what Short observed. Short is not aware of the evidence that Page is garnering, because he's not involved in the field test process. He's not observing her performance. He cannot make the call as to the arrest. So each officer is unaware of the evidence that the other one has. So it can't be a melding or a conglomeration as far as the decision, because Short's not aware of the evidence that Page is getting. Page, upon watching her walk, talk, pass every single field test, clearly is of the position that, I don't know if that's a strong word, clearly, but I think that it's reasonable to assume that after watching all that, he doesn't think that there's probable cause.
Okay, but why can't the exact same facts be characterized a little bit differently? Namely, that Short saw enough between her behavior while driving and her alcoholic breath and her slurred speech and whatever, when he first confronted her, that he saw enough to arrest her. But he calls Page in so that Page can do the field test, because that's what you do. Page does the field tests and she passes them. So Page says or implies that he's not going to arrest her. And Short says, she's drunk, arrest her. Why isn't it fair to say that Short had the basis to arrest her, and therefore, between the two of them, the arrest was made?
Well, first of all, I don't think that Short had probable cause to arrest her for a DUI based upon his observations. And I think that that's clear, in as much as he calls for another officer to do a DUI investigation, and he says to that officer, I thought it better if I didn't start anything. So I think that that's clear from that point. The second point, Your Honor, is that if the scenario or the hypothetical would go that Page or that Short observed everything that he observed and then was involved through the entire process and evaluated the field tests and then ordered Page to arrest, that would be a different story. I would still be arguing.
Well, Mr. Mooney, what the defense tells us, again, with citing, I'm sorry, what the state tells us is that whatever it was that Short saw, he communicated to Page before the arrest. That's clear from the brief. Your reply brief doesn't dispute that. And I don't remember this argument having been made in this form before the last time. I'm just wondering whether your whole position is premised upon a factual scenario that's not supported by the record.
Your Honor, we made the argument in both the briefs that in order for something to be considered in probable cause, it would have had to have been communicated from Short to Page. I made that argument in the lower court, and in the prior.
It's not if it's in your reply brief. I missed it.
Your Honor, I'd like to reserve the remainder of the time for rebuttal, and I will address that with Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, good morning. There are two attempts here to make compartmentalizations of evidence that don't have either a basis in the law or the basis in science. And I'll talk about the law first, and that's the argument that Mr. Mooney has made today that I suggest rightfully, Justice Jacobs pointed out, seems somewhat new to this case. And that is that whatever the first trooper saw can't be used in determining whether or not there's probable cause, and I think Justice Ridgely hit it right on the head. It's an objective standard. What in total was there? Whether or not the whatever the second trooper thought subjectively, but you also, in that objective test, take all of the totality of circumstances known to both police officers. And in fact, there is the pass-through.
Let's get the facts straight first.
Yes.
Is it a fact that whatever was known to Short was communicated to Page before the arrest?
I'd suggest, respectfully, Your Honor, at page A34 and 35 of the appendix that Trooper Page says precisely that. I don't know that he mentions all of the bouncing, et cetera, at that point, but he does talk about the driving behavior, that she appeared to be under the influence, that, in fact, the first trooper said, yes, there was that strong, Short said, there was that strong odor of alcohol. I didn't get to see her eyes because I didn't have her take off her sunglasses and I didn't continue else. But yes, I'd suggest the main gist of the facts that he had up to that point, he had told Trooper Short.
And then, all right, so then in that case, there's no legal issue of compartmentalization. If there is, it's not an issue, at least as I understand your position, that eliminates probable cause.
Yes, it shouldn't be an issue, certainly under the facts. And even if, for some reason, Trooper Page or Trooper Short didn't tell Trooper Page all of that in the beginning, I suggest it's also not a problem as a matter of law.
Well, let's move away from the even if. And as Justice Jacobs said, we're trying to understand the record. What Mr. Mooney read to us was the cross-examination. And when you get done listening to what he read to us this morning, it seems that the focus on communication between Short and Page was on the tailgating. Isn't that a fair summary of what was read to us this morning?
Yes, but I think, and I don't know that he read what was at A34 through 35, and that was the first part of what Trooper Page told him, or what Trooper Page testified to, and he said that he told him also about the odor, that he specifically didn't have her take off her sunglasses yet, but that she appeared intoxicated to him, and the flushed face, et cetera. So that there are different points at which he testifies to it, and he lays out what he knew, starting his part of this.
As I take it, the state's position is in the alternative. The first position you just articulated, you think Page knew more from Short than is suggested by Mr. Mooney. And the second is whatever he knew is really not dispositive, because it's totally appropriate to look at this as two officers acting in concert, and we should look at this subjectively under the totality of the circumstances.
Objectively, Your Honor. I'm sorry. Right. Under the totality of the circumstances, not buying what each officer subjectively knew at that time. And yes, and I believe that this court held as much recently in the case of Keene Thomas. And I apologize that that's not briefed, but as I said, this argument's somewhat new. But Keene Thomas, all the way back to, I believe the name of the case is State versus Cooley, that Thomas relied on, and that it talks about police officers acting in concert. That was the case where the Wilmington detective called ahead and said, stop that drug suspect. Here is his description, because of everything she had seen, even though the second person didn't know everything she had seen.
Before the decision to arrest the defendant, did Sergeant Short know what field tests were given and Trooper Page's conclusions about whether or not the defendant had passed the field test?
Your Honor, I don't. I only from the record, all we can tell is that there was that very brief discussion of after the PBT, and I'd suggest that the more accurate reading of the record is that Trooper Page was somewhat surprised by the PBT reading that appeared to be a well over the limit, because he said she did well on the field test. And he goes and he communicates that, showing in the PBT, and said, yeah, but she did well on the field test. And that's when Trooper Short says, she's drunk. And obviously communicating in very shorthand everything that he had seen before then, and probably at the most important point in a driving under the influence case, when she's actually driving, how she's acting in that car, how she's driving that car, what he observes when he first pulls her over.
The only problem with that is, isn't it, that anyone, drunk or sober, can follow too closely, and anyone, drunk or sober, can abruptly change lanes. So it takes a lot more than simply a suggestion of a motor vehicle violation to equate it to driving under the influence.
Not just the driving, Your Honor. I'm talking also about the behavior that he sees within the passenger compartment of the two persons, both the passenger and the driver. And he describes the yelling, he describes the, quote, girl gone wild type scene where one is, the passenger is hanging out the window, and you can
I understand he described that at the suppression hearing.
I think that would have been his first opportunity to describe it, Your Honor.
He wouldn't have had the opportunity to describe it to the trooper who he ordered to make the arrest?
I suppose he could have, Your Honor, but I don't know that there was the necessity for that much
person. The record doesn't reflect that he actually did.
No, he did not.
I thought this case, frankly, was about the significance of the results of the objective test and the way in which they either were or were not weighed by the trial judge at the conclusion of the evidentiary hearing under the motion to suppress. Totality of the circumstances, one could argue, means you don't simply focus on evidence that suggests under the influence. You focus on all of the evidence, and you weigh it. And as I understand it, the PBT was ruled out. Another one of the tests for failure to follow a protocol was ruled out. And they were the only two so-called objective field tests that were, let's characterize it as negative, that suggested under the influence. And the balance of the tests suggested someone who wasn't under the influence. Now, how does a trial judge appropriately weigh that under the totality of the circumstances?
Your Honor, first of all, I agree that that's what I believe we were coming here to argue about also from sitting through the first argument and reading the briefing. And I suggest that I'm going to give a little bit of a long-winded answer, and I apologize.
That's fine. It was a long question.
that when a judge looks at evidence in a suppression proceeding, there's really kind of three categories that they're going to look at. First category is that clearly inculpates. Then there's the second category, that clearly exculpates. And then there's that third category, which really can't do either, or may not do either, depending on the nature of the evidence, the science that's behind it, the facts of the case. And here, what the defense would want the court, in effect, to adopt is a rule that says, non-failure of a standardized field sobriety test falls in that second category no matter what. It always exculpates. You always have to give that as some exculpatory type wait. Now, that's not what they said in the first argument, but it's clearly what they write time and again, because they time and again they say, you know, the judge didn't give proper weight to the non-failure.
All right, let's stop right there for a moment. Let's compare that to one of the facts that one might argue is a subjective observation. If you're correct, that doesn't automatically mean exculpation. Why does following too closely automatically mean inculpation? Because sober people tailgate. So it's weighing all of it together that's important, isn't it?
Yes, it clearly is, Your Honor, and you have to make one total picture of all of it.
Yeah, my concern is, as we sort through this, how one can say, let's rule out as a matter of course a passing a field test that's given for the purpose of determining whether one's under the influence or not. Because it isn't always mean that somebody is or isn't under the influence. Yet, well, let's take and put great weight on the fact that someone has committed a motor vehicle violation as if only intoxicated people commit motor vehicle violations.
Your Honor, the state's not asking.
Help me understand why that's a meaningful distinction.
Sure. The state's not asking the court to do that. What the state is saying is, when you talk about the weight of a motor vehicle violation in a DUI case, you of course have to compare it to everything else in the case. Clearly, people follow too closely, they get pulled over, and there's absolutely no evidence of them being under the influence, and in reality they aren't. They just follow too closely because they're a bad or an aggressive driver. But it becomes important once you start to link it to the other pieces of evidence, including smell of alcohol, admissions, the way they're acting, and things like that.
And tell me why that isn't true of someone who passes a field test.
Again, Your Honor, I guess first of all, we have to look at the science of the test itself. And the science of the test tells us that when they were developed and normed, they were developed and normed on people known to be under the influence. In fact, we know now that Jennifer LaFay was. She had a .185, and yet she was able to pass
her. This is a probable cause issue. We can't extrapolate.
I understand, but what I'm saying is that's the reason that the science works the way it does, and that is they were normed and the statistics were developed on people who were known to have an alcohol concentration of 0.10 or above, and they're only sensitive enough to tell that, and I agree with the defense when they cite the NHTSA standards, on the two tests we're talking about, only 65 to 68% of people are going to be detected to having that. And they're known. That's how the tests were developed. They were never developed to say, the opposite is necessarily true, that if, in fact, you pass, you must not be under the influence. You may be in that 30 to 35% of people who are over the influence, who are over the limit, and the test just doesn't get you. It just doesn't detect that. It's not sensitive enough to do that. It's a tool to determine whether or not the person, it does in fact fall in that 70%.
Right, when the trial judge is weighing then whether someone passes a field test given for the purpose by the police of getting some indication of whether they're under the influence or not, does the trial judge say, well, it's just as likely they fell into the 35% who would pass it even if they were intoxicated as if they would fall into the 65% who wouldn't pass it because they were intoxicated?
I don't believe, Your Honor, that specific non-failure meaning you exhibited the requisite number of clues, will always be seen that way by the trial judge.
When is it fair for the trial judge to ever see it that way, since this is a test developed by the police, given for the purpose of inculpating someone?
I think when all of the other facts and circumstances tell him or her that, in fact, the reason that the person did not fail in this on this particular field sobriety test is they're not under the influence. They don't have that alcohol concentration. And that's going to be borne out by all of the other facts. How is the person acting? What are the other observations you see of him and her?
Well, after the trial judge removes the PBT and removes the test that I can't pronounce, the eye test.
Horizontal gaze in seconds.
Whatever.
HGN, Your Honor. That's much easier.
That would work for me if I could remember it. He doesn't know yet, theoretically, not supposed to consider what the ultimate blood or MOBAT or whatever test may be given. How does he make the decision that the evidence that inculpates the defendant outweighs the evidence that exculpates the defendant? Right. And how did he do it here?
Well, I believe in this case, Your Honor, and in fact, interestingly enough, I think the defendant even concedes it, because if you in their opening brief, page 19, they clearly say, were this the only evidence, and they're talking about the evidence other than the field tests, were this the only evidence in the case, or if LaFay had refused to perform field tests, probable cause would have existed. And I think that's exactly what the trial judge did in this case. I think the trial judge saw everything that Short had told him. I think he saw everything that Page had observed. Well, looked at the field test and said, you know what, this is one of those people who's in the 30 or 35%.
Let me follow up on the Chief Justice's question, because I had the same concern, but from a different analytical slant. You know, one of the circumstances that the judge, we all agree the judge can consider, is that there was the smell of alcohol on the defendant's breath. All right. I believed, at least from the last argument, that the response to that was yes, but there was another circumstance, and that is that this woman failed the breath or passed the breathalyzer test. Then the question is, how does the judge take that into account? Can the judge, does that second circumstance negate the first as a matter of law? And the answer, I think your answer is no, of course not. It may be a circumstance that could be taken into account, but it doesn't eliminate probable cause. Are we together so far?
No, I'm sorry. And I thought
the other side was arguing that even if the arresting officer smelled the alcohol in the defendant's breath, once she took the breathalyzer test and passed, that cancels out whatever probable cause, if any, may have existed.
If he took the portable breath test and it was below the legal limit,
if she passed the breath test.
Okay. Assuming that's under the legal limit.
Okay.
I would say yes, because that's a much more objective type of test. That's science saying you may smell this, but their BAC is actually 0.03 or 4. That's what you're smelling, at 0.03 or 4, as opposed to someone who has really been at it. So
I thought that's what happened here.
No, it did not, Your Honor.
Okay, what did happen here?
What happened was that he gave the PBT, and actually the PBT she failed, but it got knocked out because I believe he wasn't able to testify, consistent with this court's Miller decision recently, that it had been calibrated in such an amount of time. So the court said, I'm not giving any weight to the PBT. Even if it was a failure, I'm not giving any weight to it. I would suggest that a properly administered PBT, for instance, that showed a BAC of below 0.08, I think that has much greater weight in saying, you know what, you don't have a person here who's over the legal limit, because it has an there's a much more objective view of that.
How much weight would it have if Sergeant Short walked up and told you she's drunk, regardless of what you may have observed in the objective field test? And you, being a trooper, being told by your sergeant or a sergeant that she's drunk, what do? No matter if she had passed the PBT, which we understand she didn't hear.
I think in the totality of these circumstances, Your Honor, what we do know, Trooper Page knew, was that that Sergeant Short had seen quite a bit more of the actual driving behavior, the behavior in the car, the smell, the initial contact when she is argumentative and things like that, than when the uniformed officer gets there.
More is a strange characterization. As I understand it, he was changing clothes in the car as he drove by and noticed the vehicle with a passenger hanging out and girls bouncing up and down the car, following another car too closely, to the extent that that car made an abrupt lane change to get away from it. Now, how much time expired?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, what's the quite a bit more?
Well, I'd suggest that when he says it looked like girls going wild. They were yelling, jumping around. Their speech was not understandable. It was very mumbled and slurred, and that's when it drew my attention to their vehicle.
Well, that
then
didn't
he actually
include the driver. She wasn't jumping around, right?
He says they. It's unclear that he's compartmentalizing between just the passenger and her. I mean, he's talking about they and their interaction in the car. So I'm assuming that he sees both of them acting unusually in the car at one point or another.
Well,
and then
here's what the trial judge said. Trooper Page arrived within 5 minutes. Short told Page that in Short's opinion, the defendant was intoxicated, that Short was alongside the Lancer, that he heard yelling from the Lancer, that the passenger was hanging outside the window, and that the Lancer almost slammed into another vehicle on Route 1. Short further told Short, but I think he means Page, that the Lancer was following too closely and that the defendant reeked of alcohol. Short did not share his other observations at that time with Page about the driver looking at him while waiting for the light or the driver's appearance when waiting for the light. Is that factual finding supported by the record?
I believe if the court were to look at A34 through 35, I believe it is. I'd have to go back and look at the various points of Trooper Page's testimony. But I believe in some, yes, that those factual circumstances are supported by the record.
Could I get back for a minute to one of the comments you made about how the appellant concedes that if all that happened were the observations that were made at the time, shortly before and at the time that Short pulled her over, that would be enough for probable cause, right?
I believe that he added on once they were actually in the just-in-time restaurant and he actually had face-to-face interaction with her, yes.
So that being the case, if I understand the state's position, the state is saying you start out with probable cause based upon these observations. Then you call in another trooper to do some more objective tests, probably on the theory that those will confirm what you have already decided is supportable. But the tests come back the other way. And it seems as if you're saying it's okay to just ignore the tests because there's enough other evidence that would support probable cause and the tests become irrelevant. In other words, they only work if they're positive, if they're good for the state. They're called in, they do the tests because they expect those tests to confirm what the observations already had established in the officer's mind. In this case, the test didn't confirm, other than the blood test, but the other test didn't confirm it, and therefore it doesn't matter because you can fall back on the original observations. Is that accurate or not?
I'd say yes. Under these factual circumstances, the state's position is Sergeant Short could have arrested her himself without doing any field tests. The defense position is once those field tests are done, that chips away any probable cause that already existed. And the state suggests that's not necessarily true, and it's certainly not true in these factual circumstances. I think, Justice Berger, you mentioned it during the appellant's argument, and it's almost and it was a point that I was going to make, and that is, why do they do the field tests? Well, honestly, they're expected to. It's kind of the protocol now of DUI, and if they don't, what happens during the trial is, why didn't you give them field tests and things like that? But you have to understand what the field tests do.
On these facts, isn't another reasonable inference is Trooper Page never saw those other facts. He would either have to rely entirely on what Short told him, which inferentially one could conclude wasn't enough for him to immediately make the arrest that he was called to the scene to investigate. And he did the field test in order to see if there was additional evidence to support probable cause that could be gleaned from allegedly objective test. And it just didn't turn out that way.
I believe that's true, Your Honor, and I suggest that basically what you then get into is the King Thomas type situation where Sergeant Short has all the probable cause and says, arrest her. I know she's drunk from everything that I had seen. And I suggest respectfully that the defense almost admits that, or I think they say it in not so many words, that the opening brief at page 19, where they say, look, if nothing else happened basically with Paige, there would have been probable cause. But once he does the field tests and she's able to successfully get through them, then you don't have probable cause anymore. And the state suggests not so fast. That's not, first of all, how field tests work. It doesn't take into account the totality of circumstances in this case. Like I said, and I believe, although I think that it's unfortunate that the trial judge used the term innocent explanation, I think he was using the right framework, and that was that the field tests don't have that dispositive type of effect that Ms. LaFay would like to put upon them, because they, for instance, it may be she was a DUI felon, and guess what? She's more practiced at these tests, and that's why she falls in that 30-35%.
Let's assume your position prevails, but we maintain the totality of the circumstances test. Someone's pulled over for not using a turn signal. And when they're stopped for not using a turn signal, and there's a smell of alcohol on their breath. And you've indicated that you can have alcohol on your breath and not be violating any law. And then all of the field tests are performed successfully. Where do you come out on the totality of the circumstances?
I suggest that if those were all the circumstances, that's not enough. There wouldn't be a fair likelihood that person's under the influence as defined here, and that is not showing the mental and physical ability to operate a vehicle with the due care. And in that hypothetical, I'd suggest it's not enough. We have much more here in the way that Ms. LaFay acted in specifically dangerous ways, what she said, what all the observations
saw. So what you seem to be saying is that the field tests are relevant to the totality of the circumstances, and notwithstanding having alcohol on your breath, the successful performance of the field test would negate any concerns you had by the alcohol on the breath. But in this particular case, what you're saying is, notwithstanding the successful completion of the field test, the other circumstances were such, of a more serious nature, that even though you passed the field test, there was still probable cause to arrest under the totality of the circumstances.
I'd suggest, yes, Your Honor, except I suggest respectfully in your hypothetical that it's that those field tests don't add any evidence of the person being impaired. It's not that they chip away evidence that they are. It's just that you never get to that probable cause platform or threshold as you did in this case, before you gave the field test.
So, in other words, alcohol on your breath is not enough for probable cause anyway. You'd be looking for alcohol on your breath, slurred speech, bloodshot eyes, and unsteady on your feet, other things.
Other factors that I believe are present in this case. Yes, Your Honor. I see I'm well over my time. I apologize.
Thank you.
If I could just respond, this is not a zero-tolerance jurisdiction. All the evidence that the state has in this case is not indicative of impairment. It's indicative of consumption, which is completely legal conduct.
May I interrupt for a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because I want to clarify this one arguably important point. Would you agree that if Officer Short had simply arrested your client after observing what he observed, pulling her over, smelling the alcohol on her breath, seeing her face flushed, and so on and so forth, that there would be probable cause, assuming there would be no field tests, no blood alcohol tests, just that?
Well, I would not agree, Your Honor, but let me just explain that. Number one, the finder of fact would have to, as the Chief Justice pointed out, be able to assume that evidence was credible, that somehow seeing a vehicle drive by and hearing noise coming out of the vehicle, that somehow the officer could make the determination that the occupants were intoxicated. I mean, I think that flies in the face of logic, that somehow he could determine that person's speech was slurred or impaired as they're driving by.
Well, I'm talking about all the circumstances before Officer Page arrived, which included pulling her over, and or she had already pulled off the road, going up to the car, smelling the alcohol in the breath, reporting that her face was flushed and that she seemed confused. You may disagree with those facts in terms of whether they're credible, but if those set of facts, including her driving and including what he saw of the people in the car, and then what he found out when he actually spoke to her, would that, under normal circumstances, that is, you know, with nothing else being done, would that constitute probable cause?
If, and there was a video in this tape, Your Honor, that clearly showed that their speech was not slurred.
But I'm saying if we stop the clock at the point after Officer Short spoke to her, asked her for her driver's license, observed her behavior, smelled her breath, so forth, would that, with the prior activity, constitute probable cause?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because...
Why not?
Well, I think, number one, because Officer Short felt that it wasn't probable cause because he calls another officer and says...
Forget about that.
Because I don't think that the driving that he observed, the most you could say about that was maybe exhibited impaired judgment. It wasn't a situation where the car was having trouble staying within his lane, going from one side to the other. It was tailgating. And I would submit to Your Honor that being able to successfully tailgate somebody maybe is not very nice and could get you pulled over.
So you're saying the state misread your comment in terms of suggesting that there would have been probable cause?
It took it in out of context, Your Honor. What we argued in that was that those observations could be consistent with Bees, and Bees found probable cause, and we would concede, but that by definition is not a totality of the circumstances test. And the trial judge, the lower court judge, said the passing of the field test provided innocent explanations, so he didn't consider the field test. Then he went on to say, they are usually grist for the jury, where the ultimate question is whether guilt can be established beyond a reasonable doubt, which is an altogether different standard. So what the lower court says is, I'm not even going to consider those for probable cause purposes, because that's for the jury, grist for the jury. And that, by definition, cannot be a totality of the circumstances test.
Thank you. I have a
question for you. I'd like to ask you if you agree with this quotation. It's from Jim D. Lovett, Defense on Charges of Driving While Intoxicated, 19 Amjur Trials 123, Section 15, 1972. Quote, traditionally, the police have requested persons suspected of intoxication to perform certain physical tests. An inability to adequately perform was considered to corroborate their conclusion of intoxication based on objective signs. However, the successful or unsuccessful accomplishment of any of the above tasks indicates little or nothing regarding intoxication in the light of individual performance differences and the effect of various medical conditions on performance. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I don't know that I really understand exactly what his premise is there. I can just... And I don't mean to be non-responsive. It's just that to say that something tests for something, but the absence of that doesn't show the opposite, I think is nonsensical on its face. That would, you know, if you're testing for low blood sugar and the test doesn't show low blood sugar, then to say, well, that doesn't prove that you don't have low blood sugar, it doesn't make any sense. And I think that Mr. Wallace concedes that in assessing these tests, he said, well, what if you smell an odor of alcohol?
Mr. Manning, the question was, do you agree or disagree? The answer is you disagree. Is there anything else?
Yes, Your Honor. If on that specific point, I know that I'm out of time, and I apologize.
Do you think you've had an adequate opportunity to answer Justice Ridgely's question? And do you think you've answered it?
I apologize. Could you read that again, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
All right. Traditionally, the police have requested persons suspected of intoxication to perform certain physical tests. An inability to adequately perform was considered to corroborate their conclusion of intoxication based on objective signs. However, the successful or unsuccessful accomplishment of any of the above tasks indicates little or nothing regarding intoxication in the light of individual performance differences and the effect of various medical conditions on performance.
I think I understand what he's saying. I agree with him that depending on a person's physical condition, whether or not they have a bad back, whether they're over 65 years old, their inability to perform those tests has little or no correlation to being under the influence of alcohol. And I think that that's, we put some of the NHTSA standards as part of the record, and there's certain things, there's certain steps the officer is supposed to take to ensure that the environmental conditions are correct, that the person doesn't have back or neck problems, that the person's not over 65 years old, that the person's not over, I think it's 50 pounds overweight. So I think that that's correct, Your Honor. But if he's saying that passing the tests don't somehow provide evidence that you're not under the influence, I would disagree with that, because they're specifically designed that if you're under the influence of alcohol, that you wouldn't be able to pass those tests, and they stack them, that maybe you can pass one, or maybe you can pass two, but in this case is unprecedented. This particular person passed five very varying field tests, and I would submit to the court that that is very strong evidence and objective evidence that Mr. Wallace had said that if it was an odor of alcohol and a PBT, then you got to follow the PBT because that's objective. Well, that's scientific.
Let's leave it that you have now completely answered Justice Ridgely's question, and we're getting into more,
I'm sorry,
more
Your Honor.
Argument. Thank you very much.
I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel will take the case under advisement and recess.